first guest is on the line and ready to go. He was the first star of the Montreal Expos, and you know, it only was in town for 3 years off that first run. Came back again in 79, but it took 3 years. That was it. And Rusty Staub will forever be one of the faces of the franchise. And he joins us tonight. Number 10, Rusty Staub, welcome to the Kauffman Show, sir. How are you?
All right, Dave. Good to be here.
It's great to have you here. And we're looking forward to a little bit of a trip down memory lane right now. I want to ask you, what were those heady days like at the start? You had had a brief, I guess you'd played a year for Houston. You were one of the original draft picks of the Colt 45s, and then played a bit in Houston, and then came to Montreal in a trade that almost didn't happen. But what was it like, the excitement in the city? Because I'll tell you, for some of us, we just can't picture it.
Well, I actually was, I signed before the free agent draft started. I signed in 61, I think it's or three, and I played 6 years in Houston before I came to Montreal. Obviously, they had two great things, okay? They had Charles Bronson as the owner, and they had Gene Mark as the manager. And they were two magnificent people, both in their own way. Charles treated everybody just magnificently. The team was first class all the way. Mark was a little tough, but great. He was the smartest person I ever met in baseball.
Gene Mark.
Yep. So to have those two people kind of leading us, it was an amazing thing to see the excitement there was for baseball to come up there. I mean, I can remember going to one of the big squares and it was something in the Ville.
I right? was Placeville Marie.
Placeville Marie, there it is. And, my God, I was just totally blown away by how many people came.
Hmm.
It was kind of cold.
And we don't care about that, yeah.
Well, I mean, it was April in Montreal. It could be anything.
Yeah.
So I have to say that the reception we received and the way baseball was accepted there, it actually was more like instead of just being a ball game, it was more like an event, and it was just great.
And
you never knew what was going to be happening in the stands.
And I'm guessing that this was not something that you expected. What was your knowledge of Montreal before being traded to the team?
Very little. You know, I mean, I never ever been north of the border. I had no knowledge at all, really.
You're from New Orleans, right?
Born and raised.
Did you see any similarities between the two cities? I mean, beyond just the fact that there's French signs and French street names in New Orleans.
New Orleans has a few people that speak, you know, kind of a broken, more Cajun French than Canadian and/or Parisian French, which all seem to have their own lingo. And I will say that I had taken French grammar 1 year at Jesuit High School in school, which actually helped me a little, because when I realized that I could not speak to a young child or be able to do anything on television, I started, after the season was over the first year, I went to one of the language schools and I took 25 hour and a half lessons, and you know, they wanted to tell me how to put the window was open and the plate is on the top on the table. I'm telling them, no, that's not what I need to know. Talk about baseball terms. I need to talk about ordering in a restaurant and having somewhat of a small conversation with all the media, you know, where I could say words and respond to them, you know, especially the ones that were on television where you could do something.
You were known as the only player at the time to take that initiative, and I think it was, I know that it was one of the things that endeared you to the fan base in the province of Quebec and really across the country. Did other players try to do that as well, or was it really just you?
Well, I mean, after I left, I mean, I know Gary Carter tried a few things, and, I don't know how in-depth anybody went into it. Obviously, Bill Stoneman, who married a young lady from Montreal, He probably spoke French better than anybody because he stayed on and was the general manager there. He had to speak French. He had to pick it up.
He might have been the only one if he did. I don't remember him speaking much French to the press, but, you know, going through the later years.
Maybe I'm wrong, but I knew he was married to a French-Canadian lady, and my knowledge, they're still together.
Well, or he didn't learn, and that's why he got along so well with the in-laws.
So all I thought was it was just an exciting city to be in. I loved it.
And of course, you know, you talk about this this day at Placeville Marie, and you know, I'll tell you, Rusty, I'm young. My memories of the Expos were started in the '80s, and really started after Gary Carter was traded. But I've seen that black and white video of the that opening party, if you want to call it, and there was a parade, and the fans. I think every player was announced, and it looked like a mob.
Yeah.
You guys looked like it looked like the Beatles. It looked like Beatlemania, and
it was wonderful. It sure got our attention, you know, because we had no idea what to expect, you know. We had all been together in spring training. It was hot. We were going up to the Ville Muriel, and it was not hot.
Earlier,
but we got lucky opening day. The first 2 days, it wasn't too cold.
Well, opening day was, just from looking at the pictures, it looked like it was a gorgeous day. And of course,
yeah.
Brought home the victory
the
as well.
Cardinals and, well, our first games were in New York against the Mets.
Right.
When we came home, we opened against the Cardinals.
That was the Dan McGinn home run, right? Or was that the game one in New
that
York?
That was the first game. Dan McGinn hit the first home run.
Okay.
In the history of the franchise, I think that day three of us hit home runs. Dan McGinn, myself, and I'm just cannot remember who the other person is right now, but I know there was at least three of us hit home runs in that opening game. But Dan McGinn, of all people, a relief pitcher, hit the first,
which is wonderful. There was conversation earlier on the afternoon show today about trades that have hurt. And our afternoon show host, Mitch Melnick, mentioned you being traded, the Jorgensen-Foley-Singleton trade, as one of the ones that hurt him when he was young. And I'm wondering from your side how that felt after 3 years of really building yourself up to being a national icon in this country, for it to be gone like that. How did that feel?
Well, the truth is, it's the only time in my entire career where they kind of caught me unawares. Every other time, I knew something was going to have to happen, or I was very vulnerable to be moved. That one actually caught me very unawares. I have to say, I was surprised. You know, whenever you're doing as much as I was doing. You know, we had 150,000 children in that Young Expos Club. You know, I was traveling all over the country for the Bank of Montreal to go, you know, continue that movement of bringing baseball to everybody in the country because we were the only team then. I have to say that, yes, it hurt me. When they told me it hurt me, I realized I was going to be going to a ball club that could, you know, fight for a championship. They had a great pitching staff. I mean, they had won the whole thing in 1969. So, I mean, I knew all the, you know, playing in New York and what that could mean to any player who was successful, which by the grace of God, it turned out to be that my career was successful there. And I have to admit it hurt me when I found out, yes.
It also started a love affair with the city of New York, a city that embraced you. And I mean, you're not only an iconic Expo, but you're also known as one of the great Mets of all time.
Well, you know, when I went there, I told them, I said, you know, I realized what a great opportunity this is for me. But I told them the truth. I said I was caught unawares. I was not. I had no idea this was happening. And, you know, I was very involved in a lot of things up there. I said, don't get me wrong. I'm going to change my loyalties in my life. But, you know, the fact that I'm not jumping and screaming about coming to New York and having a chance to play for this ball club, don't misinterpret my quietness right now. I said, because really, it's like I was stunned. I said, I will make this adjustment, and I will be a good player here, and I am sure if I play well, the fans will respond.
We're in conversation with Montreal Expos legend Rusty Staub on the Kaufman Show. Dave Kaufman and Jay Farrar.
Rusty, as upsetting as it was for you to have left the Expos in the early 70s, I guess there was a little bit of redemption when you came back in 1979. I also, you did go back to the Mets afterwards. I remember, I'm a little bit older than Dave, and you got, of course, that famous standing ovation in 1979 upon your return. Later on, when you were playing with the Mets, I remember going to the games, and you were still getting standing ovations every time you would come back with the Mets.
Oh, cool.
And I remember seeing you I must have been about seven, eight years old. And I remember, why are they clapping for a Mets player? I asked my father. I said, that's because that's Le Grand Orange, he said. So it must have
been. That name still means the world to me.
Yeah.
It's God bless his soul. Teddy Blackman is the guy that called me Le Grand Orange. He was the first media guy he wrote it in the paper. Hmm. We had a big, I think it was after we had this long losing streak, and I had a great day against the Dodgers and caught this ball at the end of the game, almost impaled myself on the fence in Dodger Stadium. We won, and I'm pretty sure it was the day after that he wrote Le Grand Orange something or other in the headline. So really, it was Ted Blackman that gave me the nickname.
And did it stick in New York as well, or did they go back to just calling you by the nickname that you already had?
Nope, it's just, that's been it.
That's great. One thing I wanted to discuss with you, we're wrapping up right now with Rusty Staub on the Kaufman Show, and going back to New York, you've probably done more for that city than any other athlete through your Fireman Fund. And I know that you've raised hundreds of millions of dollars for, is it both police and firemen, or is it just firemen?
It's the New York Police and Fire Widows and Children's Benefit Fund.
And
it's a long title.
Well, and I won't shorten it with an acronym.
And we take the policemen, the firemen, the emergency service people under the umbrella of the fire department, and the port authority under the umbrella of the police department.
What made you start this?
Well, the truth is, I was always involved. I had an uncle who died in the line of duty in New Orleans, Louisiana, and I always had an affinity with police officers because we met so many, as youngsters. And one day I was in my restaurant in New York, and this article came out where a police officer had been killed in the line of duty. He left a wife and three kids. The oldest was five. And it just hit me, that maybe I should get up off my ass and go do something. And I did.
You did. And the face of that, of the organization, must have changed drastically after 9/11.
Well, we had about 350 families that were involved in the organization the first, like 12 years. And maybe even a little longer. But we have 9/11. There were 402 people who were badged who died in the building. What is it, 346 firemen, and, there were some single officers who had no widows or children. Our group takes care of the widows and kids. We give a death benefit to the families, but, we were there to help the families after these guys were gone. In fact, that day we lost two ladies. We lost an emergency service lady and a police lady. She was... I knew her husband. Her husband was a police officer. I've seen him at some of our events. We just had our 29th picnic, for these families once a year. So the next dinner is going to be our 28th. It's amazing. It's just, by the grace of God, people in New York realize that, there is a debt service to these families. They're making the ultimate sacrifice. This is not something that's, there's so many wonderful charities, but very few of them. Somebody is dying so that your life is better. You got to at least have the responsibility to try to help their families.
I think this is the definition of role model for all of you that are listening. You finished your career shy of, not far, but shy of 3,000 hits. You had an incredible on-base percentage. I know that on your website, it actually says Rusty Staub was not a great player. But you were a great teammate, and
You know, I don't even know what's on that website. I have nothing to do with it.
I think you just found out there, Rusty.
Yeah, time to fire your web designer.
I guess I'm not speaking very highly about myself.
Well, I think
you'll have to tell me more about what's on my website.
I think it's a testament to how humble you are, actually, to think that one of the greats in our franchise history doesn't consider himself, or maybe he does. Maybe your web designer again. Maybe you need to have a conversation with somebody. But
that's funny, I swear. I'm not.
I'm sorry.
I have a Twitter and Facebook and all these other things. That's not part of my game plan right now. I think it's great for other people. I love it.
Well, I'll tell you, there's a lot of nice things being said about you on Twitter right now, Rusty. And I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us tonight. It was a real honor.
Guys, I loved it up there. You know that.
Good. We'll hopefully be in touch down the road. Thank you again for your time, sir.
All right, guys.
Rusty Staub, Le Grand Orange, on the Kauffman Show.